The laminar wind is gliding over the highway like a crisp sheet being stripped from a bed, and Randy's finding it hard to keep the Acura on the pavement. The wind isn't strong enough to blow the car around, but it obscures the edges of the road. All he can see is this white striated plane sliding laterally beneath him. His eye tells him to steer into it, which would be a bad idea since it would take him and Amy straight into the lava fields. He tries to focus on a distant point, the white diamond of Mount Rainier, a couple of 100 kilometers west. "I don't even know when they got married," Randy says. "Isn't that horrible?"
"September 1945, Amy says. "I dragged it out of her."
"Wow!
Girl talk."
"I didn't know you were even rigged for girl talk."
"We can all do it."
"Did you learn anything else about the wedding, like..."
"The china pattern?"
"Yeah."
"It was, in fact, lavender rose,"
Amy says. "So it fits. I mean, it fits chronologically. The submarine went down in May of 1945, off of Palawan, 4 months before the wedding. Knowing my grandmother, wedding preparations would have been well advanced by that point. They definitely would have settled on a china pattern."
"And you think you have a photo of your grandpa in Manila around that time?"
"It's definitely Manila. And Manila wasn't liberated until March of 45.
"So what do we have then? Your grandpa must have had some kind of connection with someone on that U-boat between March and May."
"A pair of eyeglasses was found on the U-boat."
Randy pulls a photo out of his shirt pocket and hands it across to Amy. "I'd be interested to know if they match the specs on that guy, the tall blonde."
"I can check it out when I go back. Is the geek on the left your grandpa?"
"Yeah."
"Who's the geek in the middle?"
"I think it's Turing."
"Turing? As in Turing Magazine?"
"They named the magazine after him because he did a lot of early work with computers," Randy says.
"Like your grandpa did."
"Yeah."
"How about this guy we're going to see in Seattle? He's a computer guy, too?" "Ooh, you're getting this look on your face like Amy just said something so stupid it caused me physical pain. Is this a common facial expression among the men in your family? Do you think it is the expression that your grandfather wore when your grandmother came home and announced that she had backed the Lincoln Continental into a fire hydrant?"
"I am sorry if I make you feel bad sometimes," Randy says. "The family is full of scientists, mathematicians. The least intelligent of us become engineers, which is sort of what I am."
"Excuse me, did you just say you are one of the least intelligent?"
"Least focused, maybe."
"Hmm.
My point is that precision and getting things right in the mathematical sense is the one thing we have going for us. Everyone has to have a way of getting ahead, right? Otherwise you end up working at McDonald's your whole life, or worse. Some are born rich, some are born into a big family like yours. We make our way in the world by knowing that 2 + 2 = 4 and sticking to our guns in a way that is kind of nerdy, and that maybe hurts people's feelings sometimes. I'm sorry."
"Hurts whose feelings? People who think that 2 + 2 = 5?
"People who put a higher priority on social graces than on having every statement uttered in a conversation be literally true."
"Like, for example, female people?"
Randy grinds his teeth for about a mile and then says,
"If there is any generalization at all that you can draw about how men think versus how women think, I believe it is that men can narrow themselves down to this incredibly narrow laser beam focus on one tiny little subject and think about nothing else."
"Whereas women can't?"
"Well, I suppose women can. They rarely seem to want to. What I'm characterizing here as the female approach is essentially saner and healthier."
"Hmm."
"See, you are being a little paranoid here and focusing on the negative too much. It's not about how women are deficient. It's more about how men are deficient. Our social deficiencies, lack of perspective or whatever you want to call it, is what enables us to study one species of dragonfly for 20 years or sit in front of a computer for 100 hours a week writing code. This is not the behavior of a well-balanced and healthy person, but it can obviously lead to great advances in synthetic fibers, or whatever."
"But you said that you yourself were not very focused."
"Compared to other men in my family, that's true. So, I know a little about astronomy, a lot about computers, a little about business, and I have, if I may say so, a slightly higher level of social functioning than the others.
Or maybe it's not even functioning, just an acute awareness of when I'm not functioning, so that I at least know when to feel embarrassed.
Amy laughs. You're definitely good at that. It seems like you sort of lurch from one moment of feeling embarrassed to the next.
Randy gets embarrassed.
It's fun to watch, Amy says encouragingly. It speaks well of you.
What I'm saying is that this does set me apart. One of the most frightening things about your true nerd for many people is not that he's socially inept, because everybody's been there, but rather his complete lack of embarrassment about it.
Which is still kind of pathetic.
It was pathetic when they were in high school, Randy says. Now it's something else, something very different from pathetic.
What then?
I don't know. There is no word for it. You'll see. Driving over the Cascades produces a climactic transition that would normally require a 4-hour airplane flight. Warm rain spatters the windshield and loosens the rinds of ice on the wipers. The gradual surprises of March and April are compressed into a terse executive summary. It is about as tantalizing as a striptease video played on Fast Forward. The landscape turns wet and so green it's almost blue and bolts straight up out of the soil in the space of about a mile. The fast lanes of Interstate 90 are strewn with brown snow turds melted loose from homebound skiers' Broncos. Semis plummet past them in writhing conical shrouds of water and stream. Randy startled to see new office buildings halfway up the foothills, sporting high-tech logos. Then he wonders why he's startled. Amy has never been here, and she takes her feet down from the airbag deployment panel and sits up straight to look, wishing out loud that Robin and Marcus Aurelius had come along instead of turning back towards Tennessee. Randy remembers to glide over into the right lanes and slow down as they shed the last 1,000 feet of altitude into Issaquah, and sure enough, the highway patrol is out there ticketing speeders. Amy's duly impressed by this display of acumen. They are still miles outside of the city core, in the half-forested suburbs of the east side, where street and avenue numbers are up in the triple digits, when Randy pulls onto an exit ramp and drives them down a long commercial strip that turns out to be just the sphere of influence of a big mall. Several satellite malls have burst from the asphalt all around it, wiping out old landmarks and screwing up Randy's navigation. Everything is crowded because people are out returning their Christmas gifts. After a little bit of driving around and cursing, Randy finds the Core Mall, which looks a little shabby compared to its satellites. He parks in the far corner of the lot, explaining that it is more logical to do this and then walk for 15 seconds than it is to spend 15 minutes looking for a closer space. Randy and Amy stand behind the Acura's open trunk for a minute, peeling off layers of suddenly gratuitous Eastern Washington insulation. Amy frets about her cousins and wishes that she and Randy had donated all of their cold weather gear to them. When last seen, they were circling the Impala like a pair of carrier-based fighter aircraft orbiting their mothership in preparation for landing, checking tire pressures and fluid levels with an intensity and alertness they made it seem as if they were about to do something much more exciting than settle their asses into bucket seats and drive east for a couple of days. They have a gallant style about them that must knock the girls dead back home. Amy hugged them both passionately, as if she'd never see them again, and they accepted her hugs with dignity and forbearance, and then they were gone, resisting the urge to lay a patch until they were a couple of blocks distant. They go into the mall, Amy still wondering aloud why they are here, but game. Randy is a little bit turned around, but eventually homes in on a dimly heard electronic cacophony, digitized voices prophesying war, and emerges into the mall's food court. Navigating now, partly by sound and partly by smell, he comes to the corner where a lot of males, ranging from perhaps 10 to 40 years old, are seated in small clusters, some extracting quivering chopstick loads of Szechuan from little white boxes, but most fixated on what, from a distance, looks like some kind of paperwork. As backdrop, the ultraviolet maw of a vast game arcade,
spews digitized and sound lab-sweetened detonations, whooshes, sonic booms, and Gatling farts. But the arcade seems nothing more than a defunct landmark around which is gathered this intense cult of paperwork hobbyists. A wiry teenager in tight black jeans and a black t-shirt prowls among the tables with the provocative confidence of a pool hustler, a long, skinny cardboard box slung over his shoulder like a rifle. "These are my ethnic group," Randy explains in response to the look on Amy's face. "Fantasy role-playing gamers. This is Avi and me, 10 years ago."
"They look like they're playing cards."
Amy looks again and wrinkles her nose.
"Weird cards."
Amy barges curiously into the middle of a four-nerd game. Almost anywhere else, the appearance of a female with discernible waist among these guys would cause some kind of a stir. Their eyes would at least travel rudely up and down her body. But these guys only think about one thing, the cards in their hands, each contained in a clear plastic sleeve to keep it mint condition, each decorated with a picture of a troll or wizard or some other leaf on the post-Tolkienian evolutionary tree, and printed on the back with elaborate rules. Mentally, these guys are not in a mall on the east side of Greater Seattle. They are on a mountain pass trying to kill each other with edged weapons and numinous fire. The young hustler is sizing Randy up as a potential customer. His box is long enough to contain a few hundred cards, and it looks heavy. Randy would not be surprised to learn something depressing about this kid, like he makes so much money from buying cards low and selling them high that he owns a brand new Lexus he's too young to drive. Randy catches his eye and asks, "Chester, bathroom." Randy sits down and watches Amy watching the nerds play their game. He thought he'd hit bottom in Whitman, out there on the parking lot, that surely she would get scared and flee. But this is potentially worse. A bunch of tubby guys who never go outside, working themselves into a frenzy over elaborate games in which non-existent characters go out and do pretend things that mostly are not as interesting as what Amy, her father, and various other members of her family do all the time without making any fuss about it. It is almost like Randy is deliberately hammering away at Amy, trying to find out when she'll break and run. But her lip hasn't started to writhe nauseously yet. She's watching the game impartially, peeking over the nerd's shoulders, following the action, occasionally squinting at some abstraction in the rules.
"Hey, Randy."
"Hey, Chester." So Chester's back from the bathroom. He looks exactly like the Chester of old, except spread out over a somewhat larger volume, like the classic demo of the expanding universe theory in which a face, or some other figure, is drawn on a partly inflated balloon which is then inflated some more. The pores have gotten larger, and the individual shafts of hair farther apart, which produces an illusion of impending baldness. It seems like even his eyes have gotten farther apart, and the flecks of color in the irises grown into blotches. He is not necessarily fat. He has the same rumpled heftiness he used to. Since people do not literally grow after their late teens, this must be an illusion. Older people seem to take up a larger space in the room. Or maybe older people see more.
"How's Avid?"
"As avid as ever," Randy says, which is lame but obligatory. Chester is wearing a sort of photographer's vest with a gratuitous number of small pockets, each of which is stuffed with gaming cards. Maybe that's why he seems big. He has like 20 pounds of cards strapped to him. "I note that you have made the transition to card-based RPGs," Randy says.
"Oh, yeah. It is so much better than the old pencil and paper way. Or even computer-mediated RPGs, with all due respect to the fine work that you and Avi did. What are you working on now?"
"Something that might actually be relevant to this," Randy says. "I was just realizing that if you have a set of cryptographic protocols suitable for issuing an electronic currency that cannot be counterfeited, which, oddly enough, we do, you could adapt those same protocols to card games, because each one of these cards is like a banknote, some more valuable than others."
Chester nods all the way through this, but does not rudely interrupt Randy as a younger nerd would. Your younger nerd takes offense quickly when someone near him begins to utter declarative sentences because he reads into it an assertion that he, the nerd, does not already know the information being imparted. But your older nerd has more self-confidence and, besides, understands that frequently people need to think out loud. And highly advanced nerds will furthermore understand that uttering declarative sentences, whose contents are already known to all present, is part of the social process of making conversation and therefore should not be construed as aggression under any circumstances.
It's already being done, Chester says, when Randy's finished. In fact, that company you and Abby worked for in Minneapolis is one of the leaders.
I'd like you to meet my friend Amy, Randy interrupts, even though Amy is a good distance away and not paying attention. But Randy is afraid that Chester's about to tell him that stock in that Minneapolis company is now up to the point where its market capitalization exceeds that of General Dynamics and that Randy should have held on to his shares.
Amy, this is my friend Chester, Randy says, leading Chester between tables.
At this point, some of the gamers actually do look up interestedly. Not at Amy, but at Chester, who, Randy infers, has probably got some one-of-a-kind cards tucked away in that vest, like the thermonuclear arsenal of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, or Yahweh. Chester exhibits a marked improvement in social skills, shaking Amy's hand with no trace of awkwardness and dropping smoothly into a pretty decent imitation of a mature and well-rounded individual engaging in polite small talk. Before Randy knows it, Chester has invited them over to his house.
I heard it wasn't done yet, Randy says.
You must have seen the article in The Economist, Chester says.
That's right.
If you'd seen the article in The New York Times, you'd know that the article in The Economist was wrong. I am now living in the house.
Well, it'd be fun to see it, Randy says.
Notice how well paved my street is,
Chester says sourly, half an hour later. Randy has parked his hammered and scraped Acura in the guest parking lot of Chester's house, and Chester has parked his 1932 Duesenberg Roadster in the garage, between a Lamborghini and some other vehicle that would appear to be literally an aircraft built to hover on ducted fans.
I can't say that I did, Randy says, trying not to gape at anything.
Even the pavement under his feet is some kind of custom-made mosaic of Penrose tiles.
I sort of vaguely remember it as being broad and flat and not having any chuck holes. Well paved, in other words.
This, Chester says, head faking towards his house, was the first house to trigger the LOHO.
LOHO?
The ludicrously oversized home ordinance. Some malcontents rammed it through the city council. You get these, like, cardiovascular surgeons and trust fund parasites who like to have big houses. But God forbid some dirty hacker should try to build a house of his own and send a few cement trucks down their street occasionally.
They made you repave the street?
They made me repave half a fucking town, Chester says. I mean, some of the neighbors were griping that the house was an eyesore, but after we got off on the wrong foot, my attitude was, to hell with them.
Indeed, Chester's house does resemble nothing so much as a regional trucking hub with a roof made entirely of glass. He waves his arm down a patch-hilly turfed slab of mud that slopes down into Lake Washington.
Obviously, the landscaping hasn't even begun yet, so it looks like a science fair project on erosion.
I was going to say the Battle of the Somme, Randy says.
Not as good an analogy because there are no trenches, Chester says.
He is still pointing down towards the lake.
But if you look near the waterline, you can just make out some railroad ties, half buried. That's where we laid the tracks.
Tracks? Amy says, the only word she's been able to get out of her mouth since Randy drove his Acura through the main gate. Randy told her on the way over here that if he, Randy, had $100,000 for every order of magnitude by which Chester's net worth currently exceeds his, then he, Randy, would never have to work again. This turned out to be more clever than informative, and so Amy was not prepared for what they have found here and is still steepling her eyebrows.
For the locomotive, Chester says. There are no railway lines nearby, so we barged the locomotive in and then winched it up a short railway into the foyer.
Amy just scrunches up her face, silent. Amy hasn't seen the articles, Randy says.
Oh, sorry,
Chester says.
I'm into obsolete technology. The house is a museum of dead tech. Stick your hand into these things.
Lined up before the front entrance are four waist-high pedestals, emblazoned with the Novus Ordo Seclorum eyeball pyramid logo, with outlines of hands stenciled onto their lids, and knobs in the lagoons between the fingers. Randy fits his hand into place and feels the knobs slide in their grooves, reading and memorizing the geometry of his hand.
The house knows who you are now, Chester says, typing their names into a ruggedized, weatherproofed keyboard. And I'm giving you a certain privileged constellation that I use for personal guests. Now you can come in through the main gate and park your car and wander around the grounds whether or not I'm home. And you can enter the house if I'm home, but if I'm not home, it'll be locked to you. And you can wander freely in the house, except for certain offices where I keep proprietary corporate documents.
You have your own company or something? Amy says weakly.
No. After Randy and Abby left town, I dropped out of college and snagged a job with a local company, which I still have,
Chester says.
The front door, a translucent crystal slab on a track, slides open. Randy and Amy follow Chester into his house. As advertised, there is a full-scale steam locomotive in the foyer.
The house is patterned after flex space, Chester says.
What's that?
Amy asks. She is completely turned off by the locomotive.
A lot of high-tech companies get started in flex space, which just means a big warehouse with no internal walls or partitions, just a few pillars to hold up the ceiling. You can drag partitions around to divide it up into rooms.
Like cubicles?
Same idea, but the partitions go up higher so you have a feeling of being in a real room. Of course, they don't go all the way up to the ceiling. Otherwise, there wouldn't be room for the TWA.
The what?
Amy asks. Chester, who is leading them into the maze of partitions, answers the question by tilting his head back and looking straight up. The roof of the house is made entirely of glass, held up by a trusswork of white-painted steel tubes. It is maybe 40 or 50 feet above the floor. The partitions rise to a height of maybe 12 feet. In the gap above the partitions and below the ceiling, a grid has been constructed, a scaffolding of red pipes nearly as vast as the house itself. Thousands, millions of aluminum shreds are trapped in that space grid, like torn tufts caught in a three-dimensional screen. It looks like an artillery shell the length of a football field that has exploded into shrapnel a microsecond ago and been frozen in place. Light filters through the metal scraps, trickles down bundles of shredded wiring, and glances flatly off the crusts of melted and hardened upholstery. It is so vast and so close that when Amy and Randy first look up at it, they flinch, expecting it to fall on them. Randy already knows what it is, but Amy has to stare at it for a long time and prowl from room to room, viewing it from different angles, before it takes shape in her mind and becomes recognizable as something familiar. A 747.
The FAA and NTSB were surprisingly cool about it, Chester muses. Which makes sense. I mean, they've reconstructed this thing in a hangar, right? Dredged up all the pieces, figured out where they go, and hung them on this grid. They've gone over it and gathered all the forensic evidence they could find, hosed out all the human remains and disposed of them properly, sterilized the debris so that the crash investigation team doesn't have to worry about getting AIDS from touching a bloody flange or something. And they're done with it, and they're paying like rent on this hangar. They can't throw it away. They have to store it somewhere. So all I had to do was get the house certified as a federal warehouse, which was a pretty easy legal hack. And if there's a lawsuit, I have to let the lawyers in to go over it. But really, it was not a problem to do this. The Boeing guys love it. They're over here all the time.
It's like a resource to them, Randy guesses.
Yeah.
You like to play that role.
Sure. I have to find a privileged constellation specifically for engineer types who can come over here anytime they want to access the house as a museum of dead tech. That's what I mean by the flex space analogy. To me and my guests, it's a home. To these visitors, there's one right there.
Chester waves his arm across the room. It is a central room, maybe 50 meters on a side. At an engineer type who has set up a Hasselblad on a huge tripod and is pointing it straight up at a bent landing gear strut.
To them, it's exactly like a museum in that there are places they can go and other places that, if they step over the line, will set off alarms and get them in trouble.
Is there a gift shop? Amy jokes.
The gift shop is roughed in, but not up and running. The LOHO throws up all kinds of impediments.
Chester grumbles. They end up in a relatively cozy glass-walled room with a view across the churned mud to the lake. Chester fires up an espresso machine that looks like a scale model of an oil refinery and generates a brace of lattes. This room happens to be underneath the TWA's left wingtip, which is relatively intact. Randy realizes now that the entire plane has been hung in a gentle banking attitude, like it's making an imperceptible course change, which is not really appropriate. A vertical dive would make more sense, but then the house would have to be 50 stories high to accommodate it. He can see a repeating pattern of tears in the wing's skin that seems to be an expression of the same underlying math that generates repeating vortices in a wake, or swirls in a Mandelbrot set. Charlene and his friends used to heckle him for being a platonist, but everywhere he goes he sees the same few ideal forms shadowed in the physical world. Maybe he's just stupid or something. The house lacks a woman's touch. Randy gathers from hints dropped by Chester that the TWA has not turned out to be the conversation starter that he had hoped it would be. He is considering building fake ceilings over some of the house's partitions so that they will feel more like rooms, which, he admits, might make some people feel more comfortable there and open the possibility of their committing themselves to an extended stay. So, evidently, he is in early negotiations with some kind of female, which is good news. Chester, 2 years ago you sent me email about a project you were launching to build replicas of early computers. You wanted information about my grandfather's work?
Yeah, Chester says. You want to see that stuff? It's been on the back burner, but I just inherited some of his notebooks, Randy says.
Chester's eyebrows go up. Amy glances out the window. Her hair, skin, and clothes take on a pronounced reddish tinge from Doppler effect as she drops out of the conversation at relativistic velocity.
I want to know if you have a functioning ETC card reader.
Chester snorts.
That's all?
That's all.
You want a 1932 Mark III card reader or a 1938 Mark IV? Or a...
Does it make any difference? They all read the same cards, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
I have some cards from circa 1945 that I would like to have read out onto a floppy disk that I can take home.
Chester picks up a cell phone the size of a gherkin and begins to prod it.
I'll call my card man, he says. Retired ETC engineer. Lives on Mercer Island. Comes up here on his boat a couple of times a week and tinkers with this stuff. He'll be really excited to meet you.
While Chester is conversing with his card man, Amy meets Randy's eyes and gives him a look that is almost perfectly unreadable. She seems a bit deflated, worn down, ready to go home. Her very unwillingness to show her feelings confirms this. Before this trip, Amy would have agreed that it takes all kinds to make a world. She'd still assent to it now. But Randy's been showing her some practical applications of that concept in the last few days that are going to take her a while to fit into her world view, or more importantly, into her Randy view. And sure enough, the moment Chester's off the phone, she's asking if she can use it to call the airlines. There is only a momentary upward flick of the eyes towards the TWA. And once Chester gets over his astonishment that anyone still uses voice technology to make airline reservations in this day and age, he takes her to the nearest computer, there is a fully outfitted Unix machine in every room, and patches into the airline databases directly and begins searching for the optimal route back home. Randy goes and stares out the window at the chilly whitecaps slapping the mud shore and fights the urge to just stay here in Seattle, which is a town where he could be very happy. Behind him, Chester and Amy keep saying Manila,
and it sounds ridiculously exotic and hard to reach. Randy thinks that he is marginally smarter than Chester and would be even richer if he'd only stayed here. A fast white boat comes larruping around the point from the direction of Mercer Island and banks towards him. Randy sets down his cold coffee and goes out to his car and retrieves a certain trunk, a lovely gift from a delighted Aunt Nina. It is full of certain old treasures, like his grandfather's high school physics notebooks. He sets aside, for example, a box labeled Harvard Waterhouse Prime Factor Challenge 49-52 to reveal a stack of bricks, neatly wrapped in paper that has gone gold with age, each consisting of a short stack of ETC cards, and each labeled Arethusa Intercepts, with a date from 1944 or 45. They have been in suspended animation for more than 50 years, stored on a dead medium, and now Randy is going to breathe life into them again. Maybe send them out on the net, a few strands of fossil DNA broken out of their amber shells and released in the world again. Probably they will fail and die, but if they flourish, it should make Randy's life a little more interesting. Not that it's devoid of interest now, but it is easier to introduce new complications than to resolve the old ones. Rock. Boondock is good rock. Whoever picked it must have known this. That basalt is so strong that Gutto Dengo can carve into it any system of tunnels that he desires. As long as he observes a few basic engineering principles, he need not worry about tunnels collapsing. Of course, cutting holes into such rock is hard work. But Captain Noda and Lieutenant Mori have provided him with an unlimited supply of Chinese laborers. At first, the chatter of their drills drowns out the sounds of the jungle. Later, as they burrow into the earth, it fades to a thick, tamping beat, leaving only the buzzing drone of the air compressors. Even at night, they work by the dim light of lanterns, which cannot penetrate the canopy overhead. Not that MacArthur is sending observation planes over Luzon in the middle of the night, but work lights shining up on the mountain would be noticed by the lowland Filipinos. The inclined shaft connecting the bottom of Lake Yamamoto to Golgotha is by far the longest part of the complex, but it need not have a very great diameter, just big enough for a single worker to worm his way up to the end and operate his drill. Before the lake is created, Gutto Dengo has a crew dig the extreme upper end of that shaft, tunneling out and down from the riverbank with a dip angle of some 20 degrees. This excavation continually fills up with water. It is effectively a well, and removing the waste rock is murder because it all has to be hauled uphill. So, when it has proceeded for some 5 meters, Gutto Dengo has the opening sealed up with stones and mortar. Then he has the latrines filled in and the area around the lake cleared of workers. They can do nothing now but contaminate the place with evidence. Summer has arrived, the rainy season on Luzon, and he is worried that rain will find the ruts worn into the soil by the Chinese workers' feet and turn them into gullies impossible to conceal. But the unusually dry weather holds, and vegetation rapidly takes root on the bare ground. Gutto Dengo is faced with a challenge that would seem familiar to the designer of a garden back home. He needs to create an artificial formation that seems natural. It needs to look as though a boulder rolled down the mountain after an earthquake and wedged itself in a bottleneck of the Yamamoto River. Other rocks and the logs of dead trees piled up against it, forming a natural dam that created the lake. He finds the boulder he needs sitting in the middle of the riverbed about a kilometer upstream. Dynamite would only shatter it, and so he brings in a stout crew of workers with iron levers, and they get it rolling. It goes a few meters and stops. This is discouraging, but the workers have the idea now. Their leader is Wing, the bald Chinese man who helped Gutto Dengo bury the corpse of Lieutenant Ninomaya. He has the mysterious physical strength that seems to be common among bald men, and he has a kind of mesmerizing leadership power over the other Chinese. He somehow manages to get them excited about moving the boulder. Of course, they have to move it because Gutto Dengo has let it be known that he wants it moved, and if they don't, Lieutenant Mori's guards will shoot them on the spot, but
Above and beyond this, they seem to welcome the challenge. Certainly, standing in cool running water beats working down in the mine shafts of Golgotha. The boulder is in place 3 days later. The water divides around it. More boulders follow, and the river begins to pool. Trees do not naturally sprout from lakes, and so Gododango has workers fell the ones that are standing here, not with axes, though. He shows them how to excavate the roots one at a time, like archaeologists digging up a skeleton, so that it looks as if the trees were uprooted during a typhoon. These are piled up against the boulders, and smaller stones and gravel follow. Suddenly, the level of Lake Yamamoto begins to rise. The dam leaks, but the leaks peter out as more gravel and clay are dumped in behind it. Gododango is not above plugging troublesome holes with sheets of tin as long as it's down where no one will ever see it. When the lake has reached its desired level, the only sign it's man-made is a pair of wires trailing up onto its shore, rooted in demolition charges molded into the concrete plug on its bottom. Golgotha is cut into a ridge of basalt that is flung out from the base of the mountain, like a buttress root from the trunk of a jungle tree that separates the watersheds of the Yamamoto and Tojo rivers. Moving southwards from the summit of Calvary, then, one would pass through the teeming bowl of its extinct crater first, over the remains of its southern rim, and then onto the gradual downward slope of a much larger mountain on which Calvary's cinder cone is just a blemish like a wart on a nose. The small Yamamoto River runs generally parallel to the Tojo on the other side of the basalt ridge, but descends more gradually, so that its elevation gets higher and higher above that of the Tojo River as both work their way down the mountain. At the site of Lake Yamamoto, it is 50 meters above the Tojo. By drilling the connecting tunnel in a southeasterly direction rather than straight east underneath the ridge, one can bypass a chain of rapids and a waterfall on the Tojo which drop that river's elevation to almost 100 meters beneath the bottom of the lake. When the general comes to inspect the works, Gododango astonishes him by taking him up the Tojo River in the same Mercedes he used to drive down from Manila. By this point, the workers have constructed a single-lane road that leads from the prison camp up the rocky bed of the river to Golgotha.
"Fortune has smiled on our endeavor by giving us a dry summer," Gododango explains. "With the water low, the riverbed makes an ideal roadway. The rise in altitude is gentle enough for the heavy trucks that we will be bringing in. When we are finished, we will create a low dam near the site that will conceal the most obvious signs of our work. When the river rises to its normal height, there will be no visible trace that men were ever here."
"That is a good idea," the general concedes, then mumbles something to his aide about using the same technique at the other sites. The aide nods and heights and writes it down. A kilometer into the jungle, the banks rise up into vertical walls of stone that climb higher and higher above the water's level until they actually overhang the river. There is a hollow in the stony channel where the river broadens out. Just upstream is the waterfall. At this point, the road makes a left turn directly into the rock wall and stops. Everyone gets out of the Mercedes. Gododango, the general, his aide, and Captain Noda. The river runs over their feet, ankle deep. A mouse hole has been dug into the rock here. It has a flat bottom and an arched ceiling. A 6-year-old could stand upright in here, but anyone taller will have to stoop. A pair of iron rails runs into the opening.
"The main drift," says Gododango.
"This is it?"
"The opening is small so that we can conceal it later," Captain Noda explains, cringing. "But it gets wider inside."
The general looks pissed off and nods. Led by Gododango, all four men squat and duck walk into the tunnel, pushed by a steady current of air.
"Notice the excellent ventilation," Captain Noda enthuses, and Gododango grins proudly.
10 meters in, they are able to stand up. Here, the drift has the same vaulted shape, but it's 6 feet high and 6 wide, buttressed by reinforced concrete arches that they have poured in wooden forms on the floor. The iron rails run far away into blackness. A train of 3 mine cars sits on them,
sheet metal boxes filled with shattered basalt.
"We remove waste by hand-tramming," Goto Dango explains. "This drift and the rails are perfectly level to keep the cars from running out of control."
The general grunts. Clearly he has no respect for the intricacies of mine engineering.
"Of course, we will use the same cars to move the material into the vault when it arrives," Captain Noda says.
"Where did this waste come from?"
the general demands. He is pissed off that they are still digging at this late stage.
"From our longest and most difficult tunnel, the inclined shaft to the bottom of Lake Yamamoto," says Goto Dango. "Fortunately, we can continue to extend that shaft even while the material is being loaded into the vault. Outgoing cars will carry waste from the shaft work. Incoming cars will carry the materiel."
He stops to thrust his finger into a drill hole in the ceiling.
"As you can see, all of the holes are ready for the demolition charges. Not only will those charges bring down the ceiling, but they will leave the surrounding rock so rotten as to make horizontal excavation very difficult."
They walk down the main drift for 50 meters.
"We are in the heart of the ridge now," Goto Dango says. "Halfway between the two rivers. The surface is 100 meters straight up."
In front of them, the string of electric lights terminates in blackness. Goto Dango gropes for a wall switch.
"The vault,"
he says, and hits the switch. The tunnel has abruptly broadened into a flat-bottomed chamber with an arched ceiling, shaped like a Quonset hut, lined with concrete massively ribbed every couple of meters. The floor of the vault is perhaps the size of a tennis court. The only opening is a small vertical shaft rising up from the middle of the ceiling, just barely big enough to contain a ladder and a human body. The general folds his arms and waits while the aide goes around with the tape measure, verifying the dimensions.
"We go up," says Goto Dango,
and, without waiting for the general to bristle, mounts the ladder up into the shaft. It only goes up for a few meters, and then they are in another drift with another narrow-gauge railway on the floor. This one's shored up with timbers hewn from the surrounding jungle.
"The haulage level, where we move rock around," Goto Dango explains,
when they have all convened at the top of the ladder.
"You asked about the waste in those cars. Let me show you how it got there."
He leads the group down the tracks for 20 or 30 meters, past a train of battered cars.
"We are headed northwest, towards Lake Yamamoto."
They reach the end of the drift, where another narrow shaft pierces the ceiling. A fat, reinforced hose runs up into it, compressed air keening out through tiny leaks. The sound of drills can be heard from very far away.
"I would not recommend that you look up this shaft, because stray rocks occasionally come down from where we are working," he warns. "But if you looked straight up, you would see that about 10 meters above us, this shaft comes up into the floor of a narrow inclined shaft that goes uphill that way."
He motions northwest.
"Towards the lake and downhill that way."
He turns 180 degrees back towards the vault.
"Towards the fool's chamber,"
the general says, with a relish.
"Hi,"
answers Goto Dango.
"As we extend the shaft up toward the lake, we rake the broken rock downhill with an iron hoe drawn by a winch, and when it reaches the top of this vertical shaft that you see here, it falls down into waiting cars. From here, we can drop it down into the main vault, and from there, hand-tram it to the exit."
"What are you doing with all the waste?"
asks the general.
"Spreading some of it down the riverbed, using it to make the roadway that we drove up on. Some of it is stored above to backfill various ventilation shafts. Some is being crushed into sand for a trap, which I will explain later."
Goto Dango leads them back in the direction of the main vault, but they pass by the ladder and turn into another drift, then another. Then the drifts become narrow and cramped again, like the one at the entrance.
"Please forgive me for leading you into what seems like a three-dimensional maze,"
Goto Dango says.
"This part of Golgotha is intentionally confusing. If a thief ever manages to break into the fool's chamber from above, he will expect to find a drift through which the material was loaded into it. We have left one there for him to find. A false drift that seems to lead away towards the Tojo River. Actually, a whole complex of false drifts and shafts that will all be demolished by dynamite when we are finished. It will be so difficult, not to mention dangerous, for the thief to work his way through so much rotten rock that he will probably be satisfied with what he finds in the Fool's Chamber.
He keeps pausing and looking back at the General, expecting him to tire of this. But clearly the General is getting a second wind. Captain Noda, taking up the rear, gestures him onwards impatiently. The maze takes some time to negotiate, and Gododengo, like a prestidigitator, tries to fill up the time with some convincing patter.
As I'm sure you understand, shafts and drifts must be engineered to counteract lithostatic forces.
What?
They must be strong enough to support the rock overhead, just as a building must be strong enough to hold up its own roof.
Of course, says the General.
If you have two parallel drifts, one above the other, like stories in a building, then the rock in between them, the floor or the ceiling, depending on which way you look at it, must be thick enough to support itself. In the structure we are walking through, the rock is just barely thick enough. But when the demolition charges have been set off, the rock will be shattered so that reconstructing these drifts will be a physical impossibility.
Excellent, says the General,
and again tells his aide to make a note of it, apparently so that the other Gododengos and the other Golgothas can do the same. At one point, a drift has been plugged by a wall made of rubble stuck together with mortar. Gododengo shines his lantern on it, lets the General see the iron rails disappearing beneath the masonry.
To a thief coming down from the Fool's Chamber, this will look like the main drift, he explains. But if he demolishes that wall, he dies.
Why?
Because on the other side of that wall is a shaft that connects to the Lake Yamamoto pipe. One blow from a sledgehammer, and that wall will explode from the water pressure that will be on the other side of it. Then Lake Yamamoto rushes forth from that hole like a tsunami.
The General and his aide spend some time cackling over this one. Finally, they waddle down a drift into a vault, half the dimensions of the main vault, that is illuminated from above by dim bluish skylight. Gododengo turns on some electric lights as well.
The Fool's Vault, he announces.
He points up the vertical shaft in the ceiling.
Our ventilation has been courtesy of this.
The General peers upwards and sees, 100 meters above them, a circle of radiant green-blue jungle quartered by the spinning swastika of a big electric fan.
Of course, we would not want thieves to find the Fool's Chamber too easily, or it wouldn't fool anyone. So we have added some features up there to make it interesting.
What sort of features?
Asks Captain Noda, stepping crisply into his role as straight man.
Anyone who attacks Golgotha will attack from above. To gain horizontal access, the distance is too great. This means they will have to tunnel downwards, either through fresh rock or through the column of rubble with which this ventilation shaft will be filled. In either case, they will discover, when they are about halfway down, a stratum of sand, 3 to 5 meters in depth, spread across the whole area. I need hardly remind you that in nature, pockets of sand are never found in the middle of igneous rock.
Gododengo begins climbing up the ventilation shaft. Halfway to the surface, it comes up into a network of small, rounded, interconnected chambers whittled out of the rock, with fat pillars left in place to hold up the ceiling. The pillars are so thick and numerous that it's not possible to see very far, but when the others have arrived, and Gododengo begins leading them from room to room, they learn that this system of chambers extends for a considerable distance. He takes them to a place where an iron manhole is set into a hole in the rock wall, sealed in place with tar.
There are a dozen of these, he says. Each one leads to the Lake Yamamoto shaft, so pressurized water will be behind it. The only thing holding them in place right now is tar. Obviously not enough to hold back the pressure of the lake water. But when we have filled these rooms with sand, the sand will hold the manholes in place. But if a thief breaks in and removes the sand, the manhole explodes out of its seat, and millions of gallons of water force their way into its excavation.
From there, another climb up the shaft takes them to the surface, where Captain Noda's men are waiting to move the ventilation fan out of their way, and his aide is waiting with bottles of water and a pot of green tea. They sit at a folding table and refresh themselves. Captain Noda and the general talk about goings-on in Tokyo. Evidently, the general just flew down from there a few days ago. The general's aide performs calculations on his clipboard. Finally, they hike up over the top of the ridge to take a look at Lake Yamamoto. The jungle is so thick that they almost have to fall into it before they can see it. The general pretends to be surprised that it is an artificial body of water. Goto Dengo takes this as a high commendation. They stand, as people often will, at the edge of the water and say nothing for a few minutes. The general smokes a cigarette, squinting through the smoke across the lake, and then turns to the aide and nods. This seems to communicate much to the aide, who turns to face Captain Noda and pipes up with a question.
What is the total number of workers?
Now, 500.
The tunnels were designed with this assumption?
Captain Noda shoots an uneasy look at Goto Dengo.
I reviewed Lieutenant Goto's work and found that it was compatible with that assumption.
The quality of the work is the highest we have seen,
the aide continues.
Thank you. Or expect to see,
the general adds.
As a result, we may wish to increase the amount of material stored at this site.
I see.
Also, the schedule may have to be greatly accelerated.
Captain Noda looks startled.
He has landed on Leyte with a very great force,
the general says bluntly, as if this had been expected for years.
Leyte? But that is so close.
Precisely.
It is insane,
Noda raves.
The Navy will crush him. It is what we have been waiting for all these years, the decisive battle.
The general and the aide stand uncomfortably for a few long moments, seemingly unable to speak. Then the general fixes Noda with a long, frigid stare.
The decisive battle was yesterday.
Captain Noda whispers,
I see.
He suddenly looks about 10 years older, and he is not at a point in his life where he can spare 10 years.
So, we may accelerate the work. We may bring more workers for the final phase of the operation,
says the aide in a soft voice.
How many? The total may reach 1,000.
Captain Noda stiffens, grunts out a
hi,
and turns towards Goto Dengo.
We will need more ventilation shafts.
But, sir, with all due respect, the complex is very well ventilated.
We will need more deep, wide ventilation shafts,
Captain Noda says.
Enough for an additional 500 workers.
Oh.
Begin the work immediately.
The Most Cigarettes. To Randy at Epiphyte.com. From Cantrell at Epiphyte.com. Subject, Pontifex Transform. Tentative verdict.
Randy, I forwarded the Pontifex Transform to the Secret Admirer's mailing list as soon as you forwarded it to me, so it has been rattling around there for a couple of weeks now. Several very smart people have analyzed it for weaknesses and found no obvious flaws. Everyone agrees that the specific steps involved in this transform are a little bit peculiar and wonders who came up with them and how, but that is not uncommon with good crypto systems. So the verdict for now is that Root at Arutatorum.org knows what he's doing, notwithstanding his strange fixation on the number 54. Cantrell.
Andrew Loeb, Avi says. He and Randy are enduring some kind of a forced march up the beach in Pacifica. Randy's not sure why. Over and over again, Randy is surprised by Avi's physical vigor. Avi looks like he is wasting away from some vague disease invented as a plot device by a screenwriter. He is kind of tall, but this just makes him seem more perilously drawn out. His slender body is a tenuous link between huge feet and a huge head. He has the profile of a lump of silly putty that has been drawn apart until the middle part is just a tendril, but he can stomp up a beach like a marine. It is January, after all, and according to the Weather Channel, there is this flume of water vapor originating in a tropical storm about halfway between Nippon and New Guinea, and jetting directly across the Pacific and taking a violent left turn just about here. The waves thrashing the beach, not that far away, are so big that Randy has to look slightly upwards to see their crests. He has been telling Avi all about Chester, and Avi has, Randy thinks, used this as a segue into reminiscing about the old days back in Seattle. It is somewhat unusual for Avi to do this. He tends to be very disciplined about having any given conversation be either business or personal, but never both at once.
"I'll never forget," Randy says, "going up to the roof of Andrew's building to talk to him about the software, thinking to myself, gosh, this is kind of fun, and watching him just slowly and gradually go berserk before my eyes. It could almost make you believe in demonic possession." "Well, his dad apparently believed in it," Avi says. "It was his dad, right?"
"It's been a long time. Yeah, I think it was his mom who was the hippie who had him in this commune, and then his dad was the one who extracted him from there, forcibly. He brought in these paramilitary guys from northern Idaho to actually do the job. They literally took Andrew out in a bag, and then put him through all kinds of repressed memory therapy to prove that he'd been satanically ritually abused."
This tweaks Avi's interest.
"Do you think his dad was in the militia thing?"
"I only met him once. During the lawsuit, he took my deposition. He was just this Orange County white shoe lawyer in a big practice with a bunch of Asians and Jews and Armenians. So I assumed he was just using the Aryan Nations guys because they were convenient and for sale."
Avi nods, apparently finding that a satisfactory hypothesis.
"So he was probably not a Nazi. Did he believe in the satanic ritual abuse?"
"I doubt it," Randy says. "Though after spending some time with Andrew, I found it highly plausible."
"Do we have to talk about this? Gives me the creeps," Randy says. "Depresses me.
I recently learned what became of Andrew," Avi says. "I saw his website a while ago. I'm speaking of very recent developments."
"Well, let me guess. Suicide?
Nope.
Serial killer?
Nope.
Thrown into prison for stalking someone?"
"He is not dead or in prison," Avi says.
Is this anything to do with his hive mind?"
"Nope."
"Are you aware that he went to law school?"
"Yeah." "Is this something to do with his legal career?"
"It is."
"Well, if Andrew Loeb is practicing law, it must be some really annoying and socially non-constructive form of it. Probably something to do with suing people on light pretexts."
"Excellent," Abby says. "You're getting warm now."
"Okay. Don't tell me, let me think," Randy says. "Is he practicing in California?"
"Yes."
"Oh, well, I've got it then."
"You do?"
"Yes. Andrew Loeb would be one of these guys who gins up minority shareholder lawsuits against high-tech companies."
Avi smiles with his lips pressed tightly together and nods.
"He'd be perfect," Randy continues, "because he would be a true believer. He wouldn't think that he was just out there being an asshole. He would really, truly, sincerely believe that he was representing this class of shareholders who had been satanically, ritually abused by the people running the company. He would work 36 hours at a stretch digging up dirt on them. Corporate memories that had been repressed. No trick would be too dirty. Because he would be on the side of righteousness. He would only sleep or eat under medical orders."
"I can see that you got to know him incredibly well," Avi says.
"Wow. So whom is he suing at the moment?"
"Us," Avi says.
There is now this 5-minute stoppage in the conversation, and in the hike, and possibly in some of Randy's neurological processes. The color map of his vision goes out of whack. Everything's in extremely washed-out shades of yellow and purple, like someone's clammy fingers are around his neck, modulating the flow in his carotids to the bare minimum needed to sustain life. When Randy finally returns to full consciousness, the first thing he does is to look down at his shoes, because he is convinced, for some reason, that he is sunk into the wet sand to his knees. But his shoes are barely making an impression on the firmly packed sand. A big wave collapses into a sheet of foam that skims up the beach and divides around his feet.
"Gollum," Randy says.
Was that an utterance or some kind of physiological transient? Avi says.
Gollum. Andrew is Gollum.
Well, Gollum is suing us.
Us? As in you and me?
He asks. It takes Randy about a full minute of time to get these words around his tongue.
He's suing us over the game company?
Avi laughs.
It's possible, Randy says. Chester told me that the game company is now like the size of Microsoft or something.
Andrew Loeb has filed a minority shareholder lawsuit against the board of directors of Epiphyte 2 Corporation, Avi says. Randy's body has now finally had time to deploy a full-on fight-or-flight reaction. Part of his genetic legacy is a stupendous badass. This must have been very useful when saber-toothed tigers tried to claw their way into his ancestors' caves, but is doing him absolutely no good in these circumstances.
On behalf of whom?
Oh, come on, Randy. There aren't that many candidates.
Springboard Capital?
You told me yourself that Andrew's dad was a White Shoe Orange County lawyer. Now, archetypally, where would a guy like that put his retirement money?
Oh, shit.
That's right. Bob Lowe, Andrew's dad, got in on Avcla very early. He and the dentist have been sending each other Christmas cards for like 20 years. And so when Bob Loeb's idiot son graduated from law school, Bob Loeb, knowing full well that the kid was too much of a head case to be employable anywhere else, paid a call on Dr. Hubert Kepler, and Andrew's been working for him ever since.
Fuck, fuck, Randy says. All these years, treading water.
How's that?
That time in Seattle during the lawsuit was a fucking nightmare. I came out of it dead broke, without a house, without anything except a girlfriend and a knowledge of Unix.
Well, that's something, Avi says. Normally those two are mutually exclusive.
Shut up,
Randy says. I'm trying to agonize.
Well, I think that agonizing is so fundamentally pathetic that it borders on funny, Avi says.
But please, go ahead.
Now, after all those years, all that fucking work, I'm back where I started. A net worth of zero. Except this time I don't even have a girlfriend, per se.
Well, Avi says, to begin with, I think it's better to aspire to having Amy than to actually have Charlene.
Ouch. You are a cruel man.
Sometimes wanting is better than having.
Well, that's good news, Randy says brightly.
Because, look at Chester. Would you rather be Chester or you?
Okay, okay.
Also, you have a substantial amount of stock in Epiphyte, which I'm quite convinced is worth something.
Well, that all depends on the lawsuit, right? Randy says. Have you actually seen any of the documents?
Of course I have, Avi says, irked. I'm the president and CEO of the fucking corporation.
Well, what's this beef? What's the pretext for the lawsuit?
Apparently the dentist is convinced that Semper Marine has stumbled upon some kind of vast hoard of sunken war gold as a direct byproduct of the work they did for us.
He knows this, or he suspects this?
Well, Avi says, reading between the lines, I gather that he only suspects it. Why do you ask?
Never mind for now. But he's going after Semper Marine, too?
No, that would rule out the lawsuit he's filing against Epiphyte.
What do you mean?
His point is that if Epiphyte had been competently managed, if we had exercised due diligence, then we would have drawn up a much more thorough contract with Semper Marine than we did.
We've got a contract with Semper Marine.
Yes, Avi says. And Andrew Loeb is disparaging it as little better than a handshake agreement. He asserts that we should have turned negotiations over to a big-time law firm with expertise in maritime and salvage law, that such a law firm would have anticipated the possibility that the side-scan sonar plots created by Semper Marine for the cable project would reveal something like a sunken wreck.
Ah, Jesus Christ.
Avi gets a look of forced patience. Andrew has produced, as exhibits, actual copies of actual contracts that other companies made in similar circumstances, which all contain such language. He argues is practically boilerplate stuff, Randy.
I.e. that it's gross negligence to have failed to put it in our contract with Semper.
Precisely. Now, Andrew's lawsuit can't go anywhere unless there are some damages. Can you guess what the damages are in this case?
If we'd made a better contract, then Epiphyte would own a share of what is salvaged from the submarine,
As it is, we and the shareholders get nothing, which constitutes obvious damages.
Andrew Loeb himself could not have put it any better.
Well, what do they expect us to do about it? It's not like the corporation has deep pockets. We can't give them a cash settlement.
Oh, Randy, it's not about that. It's not like the dentist needs our cigar box full of petty cash. It's a control thing.
He wants a majority share in Epiphyte.
Yes, which is a good thing.
Randy throws back his head and laughs.
The dentist can have any company he wants, says Avi.
But he wants Epiphyte. Why?
Because we are badass, Randy. We have got the crypt contract. We have got the talent. The prospect of running the world's first proper data haven and creating the world's first proper digital currency is fantastically exciting.
Well, I can't tell you how excited I am.
You should never forget what a fundamentally strong position we are in. We are like the sexiest girl in the world, and all of this bad behavior on the dentist's part is just his way of showing that he wants to mate with us.
And control us.
Yes. I'm sure that Andrew has been ordered to produce an outcome in which we are found negligent and liable for damage, and then upon looking into our books, the court will find that the damages exceed our ability to pay, at which point the dentist will magnanimously agree to take his payment in the form of Epiphyte stock.
Which will strike everyone as poetic justice because it will also enable him to take control of the company and make sure it's managed competently.
Abby nods.
So that's why he's not going up against Semper Marine. Because if he recovers anything from them, it renders his beef against us null and void.
Right. Although that would not prevent him from suing them later, after he's gotten what he wanted from us.
So, oh, Jesus, this is perverse, Randy says. Every valuable item that the Shaftos pull up from that wreck actually gets us in deeper trouble.
Every nickel that the Shaftos make is a nickel of damages that we allegedly inflicted on the shareholders.
I wonder if we can get the Shaftos to suspend the salvage operation.
Andrew Loeb has no case against us, Abby says, unless he can prove that the contents of that wreck are worth something. If the Shaftos keep bringing stuff up, that's easy. If they stop bringing stuff up, then Andrew will have to establish the value of the wreck in some other way.
Randy grins. That's going to be really difficult for him to do, Abby. The Shaftos don't even know what's down there. Andrew probably doesn't even have the coordinates of the wreck.
There is a latitude and longitude specified in the lawsuit.
Fuck! To how many decimal places?
I don't remember. The precision didn't reach out and poke me in the eye.
How the hell did the dentist learn about this wreck? Doug has been trying to keep it secret.
And he knows a few things about operational secrecy.
You yourself told me, Avi says, that the Shaftos had brought in a German television producer. That doesn't sound like secrecy to me.
But it is. They flew this woman into Manila, put her on board Glory 4, allowed her to take minimal baggage, went through her stuff to verify she didn't have a GPS, took her out into the South China Sea and ran in circles for a while so she couldn't even use dead reckoning, then took her to the site.
I've been on Glory. It's got GPS readouts all over the place.
No, they didn't let her see any of that stuff. There's no way a guy like Doug Shaftos would screw this up.
Well, Abby says, the Germans aren't the most plausible source for the leak anyway. Do you remember the Bolobolos?
Filipino syndicate they used to pimp for Victoria Vigo, the dentist's wife. Probably set up the liaison between her and Kepler. Hence, presumably, still has influence over the dentist.
I would phrase it differently. I would say that they have a long-standing relationship with the dentist that probably works both ways. And I'm thinking that they got wind of the salvage operation somehow. Maybe a high-ranking Bolobolo overheard something in the German television producer's hotel. Maybe a low-ranking one has been keeping an eye on the Shaftos, taking note of the special equipment they've been shipping in.
Randy nods. Yeah, that works. Supposedly the Bolobolos have a big presence at Naya. They would notice something like an underwater ROV being rush-shipped to Douglas MacArthur Shafto. So I'll buy that.
Okay.
But that wouldn't give them the latitude and longitude.
I'll bet you half of my valuable stock in Epiphyte Corp that they used Spot for that.
Spot? Oh, rings a bell. French photo imaging satellite?
Yeah. You can buy time on Spot for a very reasonable fee. And it's got enough resolution to distinguish Glory 4 from, say, a container ship or an oil tanker.
so all they had to do was wait until their spies on the waterfront told them that Glory was out to sea, outfitted for salvage work, and then used Spot to locate them.
"What kind of precision can Spot provide in terms of latitude and longitude?" Randy asks.
"That's a very good question. I'll have someone look into it," Abby says.
"If it's to within 100 meters, then Andrew can find the wreck by just sending some people there. If it's much more than that, he'll have to go out and do a survey of his own.
Unless he subpoenas the information from us," Abby says.
"I'd like to see Andrew Loeb go up against the Philippine legal system."
"You aren't in the Philippines, remember?"
Randy swallows, and it comes out sounding like Gollum again.
"Do you have any information about that wreck on your laptop?"
"If I do, it's encrypted."
"So he'll just subpoena your encryption key."
"What if I forget my encryption key?"
"Then it's further evidence of how incompetent you are as a manager."
"Still, it's better than..."
"What about email?" Abby asks. "Have you ever sent the location of the wreck in an email message? Have you ever put it into a file?"
"Probably, but it's all encrypted."
This doesn't seem to ease the sudden tension on Abby's face.
"Why do you ask?"
Randy says. "Because..." Abby says, pivoting to face in the general direction of downtown Los Altos. "All of a sudden, I am thinking about Tombstone."
"Through which passeth all of our email," Randy says.
"On whose hard drives all of our files are stored," Abby says.
"Which is located in the state of California with an easy subpoena range."
"Suppose you CC'd all of us on the same email message," Abby says. "Cantrell's software, running on Tombstone, would have made multiple copies of that message and encrypted each one separately using the recipient's public key. These would have been mailed out to the recipients, most of whom keep copies of their old email messages on Tombstone."
Randy's nodding. "So if Andrew could subpoena Tombstone, he could find all of those copies and insist that you, Beryl, Tom, John, and Eb, supply your decryption keys. And if all of you claimed you had forgotten your keys, then you are obviously lying through your teeth."
"Contempt of court for the whole gang," Abby says.
"The most cigarettes," Randy says.
This is a contraction of the phrase, "We could end up in prison married to the guy with the most cigarettes," which Abby coined during their earlier Andrew-related legal troubles and had so many occasions to repeat that it was eventually reduced to this vestigial 3 words. Hearing it come out of his own mouth takes Randy back a few years and fills him with a spirit of defiant nostalgia. Although he would feel considerably more defiant if they had actually won that case.
"I am just trying to figure out whether Andrew would know of Tombstone's existence," Abby says.
He and Randy begin following their own footprints back towards Abby's house. Randy notices that his stride is longer now.
"Why not? The dentist's due diligence people have been lodged in our butt cracks ever since we gave them those shares."
"I detect some resentment in your voice, Randy."
"Not at all."
"Perhaps you disagree with my decision to settle the earlier breach of contract lawsuit by giving the dentist some Epiphyte shares."
"It was a sad day, but there was no other way out of the situation."
"Okay.
If I'm going to resent you for that, Abby, then you should resent me for not having made a better contract with Semper Marine."
"Ah, but you did. Handshake deal, 10%, right?"
"Right. Let's talk about Tombstone."
"Tombstone's in a closet that we are subletting from Novus Ordo Seclorum Systems," Abby says. "I can tell you the due diligence boys have never been to Ordo."
"We must be paying rent to Ordo, then. They'd see the rent checks."
"A trivial amount of money, for storage space.
The computer's a Finex box. A donated piece of junk running free software. No paper trail there," Randy says. "What about the T1 line?"
"They would have to be aware of the T1 line," Abby says. "That is both more expensive and more interesting than renting some storage space, and it generates a paper trail a mile wide."
"But do they know where it goes?"
"They would only need to go to the telephone company and ask them where the line is terminated."
"Which would give them what? The street address of an office building in Los Altos," Randy says. "There are what? 5 office suites in that building."
"But if they were smart, and I'm afraid that Andrew does have this particular kind of intelligence, they would notice that one of those suites is leased by Novus Ordo Seclorum Systems, Inc., a highly distinctive name that also appears on those rent checks."
and a subpoena against Ordo would follow immediately, Randy says. When did you first hear about this lawsuit, by the way?
I got the call first thing this morning.
You were still sleeping.
I can't believe you drove down from Seattle in one push. It's like 1,000 miles.
I was trying to emulate Amy's cousins.
You described them as teenagers.
But I don't think the teenagers are the way they are because of their age. It's because they have nothing to lose. They simultaneously have a lot of time on their hands and yet are very impatient to get on with their lives.
And that's kind of where you are right now?
It's exactly where I am.
Horniness, too.
Yeah, but there are ways to deal with that.
Don't look at me that way, Abby says. I don't masturbate.
Never?
Never. Formally gave it up. Swore off it.
Even when you're on the road for a month?
Even then. Why on earth would you do such a thing, Avi? Enhances my devotion to Devra. Makes our sex better. Gives me an incentive to get back home.
Well, that's very touching, Randy says. And it might even be a good idea.
I'm quite certain that it is.
But it's more masochism than I'm really willing to shoulder at this point in my life.
Why? Are you afraid that it would push you into irrational behavior?
Definitely.
And by that, Avi says, you mean actually committing to Amy in some way.
I know you think that you just kicked me in the nuts rhetorically, Randy says, but your premise is totally wrong. I'm ready to commit to her at any time, but for God's sake, I'm not even sure she's heterosexual.
It'd be madness to put a lesbian in charge of my ejaculatory functions. If she were a lesbian, exclusively, she'd have had the basic decency to tell you by now, Avi says.
My feeling about Amy is that she steers by her gut feelings, and her gut feeling is that you don't have the level of passion that a woman like her probably would like to see as a prerequisite for getting involved. Whereas, if I stopped masturbating, I would become such a deranged maniac that she could trust me.
Exactly. That's exactly how women think, Avi says.
Don't you have some kind of rule against mixing business and personal conversations?
This is essentially a business conversation in that it is about your state of mind and your current level of personal desperation and what new options it may have opened up for you, Abby says.
They walk for 5 minutes without saying anything. Randy says, I have a feeling that we are about to get into a conversation about tampering with evidence.
How interesting that you should bring that up. What's your feeling about it?
I'm against it, Randy says. But to beat Andrew Loeb, I would do anything.
The most cigarettes, Avi points out.
First, we have to establish that it's necessary, Randy says. If Andrew already knows where the wreck is, why bother?
Agreed. But if he has only a vague idea, Avi says, then Tombstone becomes perhaps very important if the information is stored on Tombstone.
It almost certainly is, Randy says, because of my GPS signature. I know I sent at least one email message from Glory while we were anchored directly over the wreck. The latitude and longitude will be right there.
Well, if that's the case, then this could actually be kind of significant, Avi says. Because if Andrew gets the exact coordinates of the wreck, he can send divers down and do an inventory and come up with some actual figures to use in the lawsuit. He can do this all very quickly, and if those figures exceed about half the value of Epiphyte, which frankly wouldn't be very difficult, then we become indentured servants of the dentist.
Avi, it's full of fucking gold bars, Randy says.
It is?
Yes. Amy told me.